It is Friday, February 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a federal appeals court refuses to reinstate President Donald Trump's travel ban. Trump speaks by phone with Chinese President Xi Jinping.
The conversation, the White House says, was extremely cordial. They talked about a lot of issues.
And look out for the fashion coming up at Sunday's Grammy Awards. It's all ahead. A federal appeals court Thursday refused to reinstate President Donald Trump's ban on travelers from seven predominantly Muslim nations. The three-judge panel from the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco unanimously declined to block a lower court ruling that suspended the ban and allowed previously barred travelers to enter the United States. International Edition's Lori London talks to Anna Rose Matheson, partner at the California Appellate Law Group in San Francisco, who actively litigates in the 9th Circuit Court of Appeals.
It's a clear win for the state. The opinion is unanimous, so all three judges, including a Bush appointee, agreed in the result. And the opinion goes through, kind of at the heart of it, finds that the government has not shown it is likely to succeed on the due process claim the states make. And so procedural posture is somewhat odd here because the states moved in the district court to try to get an injunction, that is, to try to get the president's order stopped and not enforced. The district court granted a temporary restraining order, said we are going to temporarily stop the program until we can decide whether or not, after a fuller hearing, whether or not to stop this order. So the government had to show that it was likely to win and beat the states on their due process claim. At the heart of the opinion, the court rules that the government has not met its burden of showing it is likely to succeed on the due process issue.
When the judges wrote their opinion, did they give specifics on why they came to the conclusion that they did?
The court walks through a number of the preliminary issues. Both parties ended up having procedural issues that they argued. But at the heart of what the court ruled is that the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution protects due process, and that this executive order may interfere with the due process rights of some citizens or residents or loved ones from the involved state. And the court said the state could assert those rights, and because the government hadn't met its burden of showing that it was likely to be able to prove there wasn't a due process violation here, it was going to allow the lower court's order stopping the president's executive order, a Muslim ban, was going to not overturn what the district court had done.
How did it come to the decision? Is it rooted in prior cases, or did it just look at the constitutionality?
Oh, it's deeply rooted in prior cases. The court goes through and rejects several arguments the government made for why the court shouldn't be able to decide and should just defer to the president on issues of national security. And the court walks through a number of prior cases from the Supreme Court and other courts saying time and again, no, it's the obligation of courts to decide issues of constitutionality. We can't simply defer when the president says, I'm making this decision based on national security. Courts can simply say, oh, well, then we're out. Instead, the courts have an obligation to protect the rights of people who come to it. And in ruling on these constitutional issues and in protecting due process, the courts have been doing exactly what they've done for centuries and what the Constitution says they're supposed to do. The opinion goes through carefully those decisions, and it goes through the decisions of both the U.S. Supreme Court and other courts saying that the due process right of all of the involved people, the people affected by this travel ban, are significant, can't be brushed away by the administration. The government tried to make it so the court wouldn't consider those by, for instance, saying the ban wouldn't apply to permanent residents. And the court said, well, look, that's one person, White House counsel, who says that. That's not a formal modification of the executive order. And anyways, given how much the administration has been going back and forth, we don't necessarily have faith that interpretation is going to stand.
Is this likely to end up in the U.S. Supreme Court as it would, the president immediately tweeted out, see you in court?
Yes, which was kind of a funny thing for him to say, given that he just lost in court and had previously lost in the trial court. But yes, see you in court. It's almost certainly going to go up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So the U.S. Supreme Court can act quickly. They'll probably already have this flagged as something that is likely coming to them.
That's Anna Rose Matheson, partner at the California Appellate Law Group in San Francisco. She was speaking to Lori London. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's going on?
Well, how surprised are you that I'm going to begin with a tweet from President Donald Trump?
Okay.
In fact, it's a tweet that Lori just mentioned there, and others, it's been getting a lot of attention. This following the panel of the Ninth Circuit appeal denying the Trump administration's request, and he tweeted out in all caps, which is kind of shouting in internet, see you in court, the security of our nation is at stake, exclamation point. Now, a lot of people are responding. Look, there are people who are supporting the president. Here's somebody who goes by the name of Bankton. He or she is saying a majority of the country still supports the president's decision to keep America safe. And there's some factuality to that. I don't know if it's a majority as in 50% plus one, but more Americans by recent polling do seem to favor the idea of the temporary travel restrictions than those who don't. And I call it that because that's sort of the more correct term. But when the president tweets about it, he uses the term ban because I guess it's shorter. It's only 144 characters on the old Twitter. But anyway, people are responding to this. See you in court. Here's Jomny Sun. Are you going to sue the judicial branch? Question mark. Here's Casey Johnson. Quote, oh, no, not court. Say judges. Matt Visor, President Trump, after losing in court, says he will see the court in court. So there's a lot of these kind of jokes that are going around. But it underlies, obviously, the seriousness of the issue at play. I think in some ways, it social media at times like this, I think, can act kind of as a pressure valve.
Yeah.
You know, let people just kind of blow off some steam or whatnot. I think everybody realizes the seriousness of the debate that's taking place. But I think that people are just perhaps, as I say, letting off a little steam.
And it is Friday. All right. Thanks a lot, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories trending. Turkey's president approves a national referendum to add power to the presidency. Iranians celebrate the 38th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. 11 civilians are killed in fighting in southern Afghanistan. And as well, a poll says that Europeans favor a halt to immigration from mainly Muslim countries. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers have long thought that there are two types of black holes. Smaller-sized black holes called stellar black holes and gigantic, supermassive black holes. Astronomers at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics say they have found new evidence of a medium-sized or intermediate-mass black hole with a mass of about 2,200 suns hiding in the center of a globular star cluster some 13,000 light-years from Earth. While a few intermediate-mass black holes had been spotted in the past, Bulent Kisseldon, a Harvard astrophysicist, says that all past claims of finding an intermediate black hole have been inconclusive and were subject to opposition by scientists who found these findings to be equally consistent with other phenomena. Kisseldon says that scientists want to find intermediate mass black holes because they are the missing link between stellar mass and supermassive black holes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Japan's Prime Minister arrives at the White House for talks with President Trump. President Donald Trump told Chinese President Xi Jinping in a telephone conversation that the U.S. intends to honor the One China policy by acknowledging China's position it has sovereignty over self-rule Taiwan. I spoke with VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide about the conversation between the two leaders, which followed Trump's conversations and meetings with a number of other leaders.
Yeah, on the front with China, things have been really quiet. And there's some reasons for that, analysts believe. One of the probably the big reasons is that shortly after he was elected, President Trump spoke with Xi at that time. But then afterwards, he also spoke with Taiwan's president, Tsai Ing-wen. And that irritated China very much. China regards Taiwan to be a part of its territory, a province of China. And so that was the first blow. After that, then came Trump tweeting about the One China policy. And China, of course, was very irritated with that. And then there were other tweets that followed. There were the Rex Tillerson's comments about the South China Sea, and recent revelations about Bannon's comments about the South China Sea. You know, eventually there could be a war there. So there's been a lot of things building, you know, a lot of water under the bridge here. And it seems like there was no way to kind of make this happen or to get started. The conversation, the White House says, was extremely cordial. They talked about a lot of issues and even discussions, having officials have negotiations and meetings in the future, and the two leaders exchanging visits. But the key thing that seemed to have brought this together was some kind of an acknowledgement on Trump's part about the One China policy, which China says is the political foundation of its relationship with the United States. And his comment, at least according to the White House statement, was a bit guarded, but he did mention the One China policy. He did say that at the request of Xi, he agreed to honor the one, and he didn't say China's One China policy. He said honor our One China policy, referring to the U.S.'s view. It's a very nuanced term. There's a lot of elasticity in it, in its meaning, and U.S. presidents have used it over the years in different ways. But basically, what the One China policy refers to is, from China's point of view, is that Taiwan is a part of China. The U.S. acknowledges that position, but it doesn't accept that position.
Is there any indication yet as to when the two leaders will meet?
No, there's no indication yet. And if one looks at the political calendar, it seems analysts that I was speaking with today were saying that the G20 meeting in Germany could be a possibility. They're a possible place for the two to meet. It seems like the most obvious, other than the possibility that they arrange some other kind of meeting elsewhere.
Well, finally, Bill, I also wanted just to ask you, this conversation between Trump and Xi took place amid rising tensions in the East and South China Seas. Is there any indication that the two leaders touched on those topics?
No indication whatsoever about, but that is a very key issue, one that, you know, there's still a lot of, while this is a good ice-breaking moment for the two presidents, there's still a lot of issues, a lot of very contentious issues that the two need to start addressing and start working on. And how quickly they may be able to move forward on those issues is still a big question.
VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide. Well, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has become the second world leader to meet with President Trump. The two are holding a White House summit Friday, followed by golf diplomacy at Mr. Trump's Mar-a-Lago Club in Florida. Mr. Trump's decision to withdraw the U.S. from the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, his criticism of countries with huge trade surpluses with the U.S., and calls for greater defense burden sharing has caused concern in Japan. Jeffrey Hornig, a fellow at the Washington-based Sasakawa Peace Foundation, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty a key objective of the visit will be to build trust.
Trying to build the trust with President Trump, given some of the campaign rhetoric he said on the campaign trail, really caused a lot of anxiety in Japan. Another one is to pick up the pieces from the TPP that President Trump killed. And toward that end, there's rumors that Prime Minister Ame will be bringing a package of some sorts that could create up to 700,000 U.S. jobs through some private-public investments.
Interesting that he's probably, if my memory serves me, the second world leader to visit Mr. Trump after British Prime Minister Theresa May.
Prime Minister Abe was the only world leader, to my knowledge, that met with President-elect Trump. He will be the second world leader to meet with President Trump. And this is all very much a part of Tokyo trying to reinforce the message to Trump that Japan is very important, that the alliance is very important, and that a lot of the rhetoric that he said during the campaign was in fact mistaken.
Yukio Akamoto, a former Japanese diplomat with ties to the Abe government, said what we, Japan, want to know is Mr. Trump's attitude toward China.
Again, they're still trying to figure out, like all world leaders, trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House, especially regarding China, one of the big ones. And so the fear is that given how much President Trump has talked about the importance of making deals and negotiating, there's an anxiety in Tokyo that he may want to cut a deal that some people call the G2, essentially the U.S. and China divvying up the Asia-Pacific with spheres of influence based largely on economic rationale, but also having geopolitical consequences as well.
What about the defense burden-sharing issue?
We saw that Secretary of Defense Mattis went there last week and reassured Japan that the alliance is pretty much going to maintain the same trajectory that it did before the election. Of course, burden-sharing has not gone away. I would be surprised if they did not at least begin talking about that because, again, along with the economic issues, Abe really has one target there into sort of shore up the alliance. And the minute that he starts broaching the topic of the alliance, I would be surprised if President Trump did not at least say, hey, at some point we're going to have to talk about burden sharing.
That's Jeffrey Hornig, a fellow at the Sasakawa Peace Foundation. Somalia's new president says he will work to have his country removed from the list of nations whose citizens were and may yet be barred from entering the United States. Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, more commonly known as Farmajo, told VOA of his plans in a phone interview late Thursday, a day after his unexpected victory in the Somali presidential election.
It's part of my responsibility to talk this issue with the U.S. government by conveying our message to the president and his government that the Somali people are really good, hard-working people who raise their families in the United States. In the United States. So we will see if he can change that policy and exclude Somalis from that list.
Farmajo is a dual U.S. and Somali citizen who has spent much of his adult life in the United States, mostly in the northern city of Buffalo. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
The Grammy Awards are Sunday, and what people are wearing could generate as much buzz as who wins the coveted awards. Here's VOA's David Byrd.
The Grammy Awards are mostly about music, but they are as much about the fashions the artists wear as the music they make. The Grammy red carpet can offer designers an audience that they won't get from other award shows, so the top houses and designers are eager to dress the stars. George Katsiopoulos co-hosted the Fashion Police show for years with the late Joan Rivers. He says that music stars have more freedom to express their style at the Grammys than at other awards shows.
I mean, there might be a black tie attire required, but no one goes by it. No one cares. The guys can wear t-shirts and ripped jeans. The girls can wear that. Now, in mostly it's outrageous. The women can be scantily clad and super sexy, but in recent years, a lot of women, including like Rihanna, every Rihanna look is fabulous. They've been wearing like haute couture. They've been wearing designers. They've been wearing gowns. I mean, Taylor Swift, Katy Perry, which is unusual. They're treating it almost as if it is the Oscars, but it's you know, can be a little bit more out there.
Katsiopoulos says his all-time favorite Grammy look was pop diva Jennifer Lopez's plunging Versace dress at the 2000 Grammy Awards.
The absolute most iconic Grammy look ever is J-Lo in that Versace look with the palm trees and plunging down to here. I mean, I think that is just like, you can look in the dictionary and it would say Grammy red carpet and there would be a photo of that. You know, if it, that defines the Grammy red carpet, I think.
George Katsiopoulos says that in recent years, stars like Beyoncé, Rihanna, Taylor Swift, and Katy Perry have tended to wear more haute couture styles. Not as flashy, but still high fashion.
So as far as like the Grammys go, they have these really great dresses. Like this is from this French designer, Alexis Mabi. So I was saying ladies are wearing more couture looks. This isn't something you'd wear to the Oscars, but for the Grammys it works. Is it's got this like kind of weird detail that's super cool with these sleeves, and it's just a beautiful color. Yeah, this is something that like Rihanna would wear.
Katsiopoulos predicts that some stars might try something a little more daring this year, like sequined pajamas. One thing he says fans can look for is more fun styles, not something as conservative or traditional as they see at this month's Oscars. The Grammy Awards are Sunday night at the Staples Center in Los Angeles. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
That's our show. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Defense Secretary James Mattis took his first official trip abroad this month to visit two American allies, South Korea and Japan, where he reiterated the United States' firm commitment to the security of our longtime Asia-Pacific partners. In Seoul, Secretary Mattis called the U.S.-South Korea alliance a linchpin of regional peace and stability. He noted the dangers posed by North Korea's missile launches, nuclear weapons program, and threatening rhetoric and behavior. America's commitments to defending our allies and to upholding our extended deterrence guarantees remain ironclad, he said. Any attack on the United States or on our allies will be defeated, and any use of nuclear weapons would be met with the response that would be effective and overwhelming. In the face of North Korea's growing nuclear and ballistic missile threat, the United States is taking defensive steps to help protect the South Korean people, as well as the thousands of U.S. troops stationed in the country. Secretary Mattis pointed to the deployment to South Korea of a terminal high-altitude area defense system capable of intercepting and destroying North Korean ballistic missiles potentially armed with weapons of mass destruction. He also spoke of the need to continue expanding trilateral cooperation with Japan. In Tokyo, Secretary Mattis referred to the alliance between the U.S. and Japan as enduring and a cornerstone of peace and security in the Asia-Pacific region. He reaffirmed the U.S. commitment to the defense of Japan under the Treaty of Mutual Security and praised Japan for its noteworthy contributions to regional stability. Secretary Mattis stressed, however, that both the United States and Japan must not be found complacent in the face of the emerging challenges. He pointed to the threat of nuclear and missile provocations by North Korea and to increasingly confrontational behavior by China in the East and South China Seas. Secretary Mattis emphasized the necessity of maintaining a rules-based international order in which countries resolve issues like land disputes through arbitration or diplomacy, not through military force or occupation. He also insisted that freedom of navigation is absolute. Faced with the current grave security situation, Secretary Mattis said it is important for the United States and Japan to continue investing in our defense personnel and capabilities. In this manner, we will ensure that we are true partners today and in the years to come. The United States, he added, stands with our friends and allies.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States.